CBS High in the World, I'm John Batchelor, and Adrian Wooldridge, who was badgered at The Economist, is the author, Adrian Wooldridge, of The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the World. And we've moved through 2,500 years of history, right up to the 19th century now. I do not want to leave out Plato, however. I didn't have a moment to include him, but Plato writes a republic. And in the republic, there are doubts about democracy, doubts about whether you can trust people to know what's best for them, because after all, they're working very hard and they live short lives. Doubts also about whether democracy chooses the best leader. Doubts also about whether you're ever going to follow a course of action that is rewarded anywhere in this lifetime. That is in the minds of the men and women of the 19th century, as we come to not the French Revolution, but the British interpretation of the French Revolution. And Adrian identifies two schools of thought in Britain, in the United Kingdom, in the 19th century that are important to explore because they inform how the United States responds as well to the search for brains, for talent. One is the school of utilitarians, the greatest number for the greatest good. The other is the school of economists, which is self-interest. Adrian, I can't choose between them. And I don't think Britain did either. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. And in some ways, they sort of supplement each other because the people like Adam Smith and the great founders of modern economics, you know, are sort of utilitarians. And they're taking part of the utilitarian philosophy and using it to inform their arguments. And of course, the greatest utilitarian economists of the 19th century, John Stuart Mill, is you know, a pure product of utilitarianism. His father, James Mill, is a classic utilitarian. He takes things, the argument, a bit further than that. But the relationship between utilitarianism and economics is very, very close.
The contest looks to turn on what is the proper government? How do we arrive at this government? And I mentioned Plato because we haven't had time to explore the fact that I'm guessing that in the minds of all these distinguished observers of this search for talent is the idea that you can't trust democracy. Now, I'm projecting because, you know, we have prejudices in the United States you don't share in Europe about democracy. You had an older world. We are only a product of democracy. But is that doubted at this time, that you can't trust the common man, that you have to have an elite?
Absolutely. I mean, I think actually, if you look at both the American and the French revolutions, they share many of these doubts, particularly the American Revolution with Jefferson, Madison, and Adams, very tortured by the idea of democracy. And they think democracy is a great thing. They think democracy is the future, but it needs to be democracy which is guided by wise people, essentially wise men in those days. But you see that style of thinking much more in 19th century England than you do in the United States, that you have an aristocratic society, which is by its nature very suspicious of democracy, but you also have a liberal and utilitarian intelligentsia, which is highly critical of the aristocracy. It regards them as stupid, lazy, drunken, debauched, womanizing, and the rest of it. But it's also extremely critical of the masses. It essentially wants power to go to people like itself. And so you have a series of people who shape the modern state, and they do so in revolt against aristocrats, but also in revolt against the masses. So somebody like John Stuart Mill, for example, says that we should move towards democracy, but in order to deal with democracy's weaknesses, we should give more votes to the better educated.
Now the search for how can you tell talent? This plunges us into what, from the point of view of the 21st century, given what we know about DNA, this plunges us into a combination of superstition and prejudice, but it has names. And at the time it was considered the height of scientific thought. The psychometrists, and then that leads us to the intelligence quotas, the IQs. Three men come to my attention in your book, Adrian: Cyril Burt, Lewis Terman, and James Conant of the United States. And this is the 11 plus invention. What was 11 plus?
The 11 plus was an examination which British school children took at the age of 11. And it decided whether they went off to academically selective schools or they went to regular schools. And the 11 plus tried to allocate these positions at the age of 11 on the basis of how well you did in tests. And these tests were a bit like American SATs, but they all tended to be more IQ tests than just purely SAT tests. But they were standardized tests designed to discover general mental ability. I say they were general standardized tests. When you start out, they tend to be a bit rudimentary. They might be tests of knowledge. But over time, they move much more and more to being standardized IQ tests. And this system really starts in England in the 1920s, expands after the Second World War when you have universal secondary education up to the age of 15 and then up to 16 introduced, and continues to flourish right the way until the 1960s. So this extraordinary life-changing event, do you go to a grammar school or do you go to a secondary modern, is policed by IQ tests, and the person who designs these IQ tests, most of these IQ tests, and who provides the intellectual justification for using these IQ tests is a psychologist called Cyril Burt, who lived from 1883 to 1971, an extraordinarily long time, and provided the intellectual heft behind psychometry.
So Cyril Burt and his colleagues believe that they have found a way to deal with the tension that was in the 19th century between finding talent and at the same time rewarding the aristocracy. They believe they found a better method. And I'm establishing all these polls because we're going to come to the criticism from, in the 21st century, the right and the left with the search for meritocracy. We're establishing where it comes from because it was always the front edge of thinking that this is a better way to find talented people. There was no inherent prejudice in my reading of your presentation in all of these events. But there's this, and it's human nature to be contradictory. At the same time they were rewarding talent, they were rewarding social status. They were celebrating what you'd have to say is the principle that it really does matter who you were, where you were born and who you are and how you conduct yourself in public. So there's a paradox here. I think Churchill has a wonderful quote. He has quotes about everything, about how the unpropertied class shouldn't be bothered by the rules. So was that true right into the 20th century? In other words, all these fine thinkers of the 19th century, did they live with this paradox inside them? Reward talent, but at the same time, acknowledge there are superior born people.
Absolutely. And that's why I call the book The Aristocracy of Talent, because what these great reformers, meritocratic reformers, wanted to do really was to replace an aristocracy of landholders with an aristocracy of talent. And usually what they want is not to create an equal society. I think Jefferson doesn't want an equal society. Adams doesn't want an equal society. Madison doesn't. Hamilton doesn't. Say the same is true of the great liberal reformers in Britain. They want to replace one sort of hierarchy determined by birth and in the inheritance of landed estates with another sort of hierarchy based upon intellectual ability. So there is a tension here. So meritocracy is, on the one hand, a radical critique of the established social order in which earls inherit their position regardless of their brain power, but also it's an attempt to say that we need to have new forms of superiority, and those new forms of superiority should be based on essentially intellectual ability. And so, but the question is, how do you discover this intellectual ability, and how do you make sure that you're rewarding real, raw, native talent rather than just being well-educated? Because obviously people who come from wealthy backgrounds can buy better educations for themselves. And so what happens, for example, you know, to explore this tension a little bit more, is in the middle of the 19th century, you have a bunch of civil service reformers, particularly Northcote and Trevelyan in Britain, who open up jobs in the civil service to academic ability as measured by examinations. Get rid of nepotism, get rid of inheritance, get rid of sinecures, and say anybody can have this job as long as they can compete in an open examination and display their intellectual abilities. But there are two problems there. One is that if you've been to Eton and Balliol, you're going to do rather better in one of those exams than if you left school at the age of 9 and went to the chimney to sweep the chimney. And second is, unselfconsciously, they don't allow women to do this. It doesn't even occur to them that women will want to do this. So after that, you get a whole bunch of criticisms of meritocracy saying, what about providing education for the masses? And what about letting women take part in this educational competition as well as men? And that drives a lot of the history of the late 19th and early 20th century answering this question.
I'm glad you bring up the absence of women in this case until now, because when we come back, what does the presence of women do to these very well-educated men who've skipped out the part that produces the next generation? The book is The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. Adrian Wooldridge is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.